Great. So welcome back. In the next section, I'm going to do quite briefly this question of cultural barriers to the life of the mind. A few of the slides I'll skip just because I think I want to make sure I get enough time to the last section. So this is a book called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, written almost 20 years ago now by an American Christian historian, very distinguished historian, Mark Knoll. And I use this title because it's become something that a lot of Christian scholars talk about among themselves. Not because I necessarily, I want to be careful and say I'm a card-carrying evangelical and very happy and proud to be an evangelical. But I think that one thing that evangelicals don't do together that well, and he says here, taken together, evangelicals display many virtues and do many things well, but built-in barriers to careful and constructive thinking remain substantial. Now, it's not all doom and gloom. People have also written about the opening of the evangelical mind, famously the sociologist Peter Berger. And there is definitely, I think, a blooming of evangelical Christian intelligentsia. But fundamentally, I think that we do, as evangelicals, suffer from barriers to constructive engagement with the life of the mind. And the reasons for those are partially that what evangelicals have done incredibly well is linking to the popular culture and the popular mind and reaching people where they're at. And that's a huge positive thing. But sometimes that has also come with, without realizing it, imbibing from that same culture certain thought patterns that are not helpful for thinking about issues of the life of the mind. And here's a great passage from Knoll. These barriers include an immediatism that insists on action, decision, even perfection right now, a populism that confuses winning supporters with mastering actually existing situations, an anti-traditionalism that privileges one's own current judgments on biblical, theological, and ethical issues over the insights from the past, and an eerie Gnostic dualism that rushes to spiritualize all manner of bodily, terrestrial, physical, and material realities. And he says, this is a scandal because if evangelicals are the ones who insist most aggressively that they believe in sola scriptura, and if evangelicals are the ones who assert most vigorously the transforming work of Jesus Christ, then it is reasonable to hope that what the scriptures teach about the origin of creation in Christ, the sustaining of all things in Christ, and the dignity of all creation in Christ, about, in other words, the subjects of learning, will be a spur for evangelicals to a deeper and richer intellectual life. And this is from Colossians, he's before all things, and in him all things hold together. Well, what about the UK? Knoll was clearly writing to an American audience primarily, that's his background. Now, clearly, the UK is different. Europe is different. Africa, Asia, South America are different. And yeah, I think that you see remnants of this throughout the Christian worlds that we engage in. And I see this in my own field to thinking about science. I think there are substantial barriers for Christians to think about science, and I think they've done that poorly. So let me give you an example of the first of the four things that Knoll. What's one of the problems called immediatism? And I'm going to give you an example of why immediatism, the idea that you can get the full answer to a complicated problem right now. Why is that difficult? Well, here's a famous example. So, not too far from here, Sir Isaac Newton, when he worked out the law of gravity, one of the great triumphs of the law of gravity is that it very naturally explains the elliptical orbits of the planets around the sun that Johannes Kepler had famously observed. And that was a great triumph. He could show why these things are elliptical because of the two-body motion of the Earth and the sun, Jupiter and the sun. But then you start thinking about it a little bit more and you realize that in fact, not only does the Earth and the sun interact gravitationally, but the Earth also interacts gravitationally with Jupiter and with Mars and with Mercury and with Venus. And so as he started thinking about it, Newton worried and he did his calculations and it appeared that the planets, the stability of the orbits were not stable. In other words, the fact that the Earth is being pulled on by Jupiter eventually is going to eject it from its orbit. That's obviously problematic. Therefore, Newton said, God must occasionally reform the planets. So occasionally, when they're about to go bad, God fixes it, perhaps with a comet or something else. He reforms the planets. Now, his great adversary, Leibniz, objected. And Leibniz said, if God had to remedy the defects of creation, this was sure to demean his craftsmanship. That's a kind of aesthetic argument saying, well, surely it's greater if God creates it correctly in the first place than that if he has to fix it occasionally, and somehow then he didn't make gravity right. And that's a legitimate argument. If you push on it really hard, it's actually not quite as obvious that argument is strong, but definitely it's a strong argument. But I think a stronger argument is this one. I hold that when God works miracles, he does not do it in order to supply the wants of nature, but those of grace. Whoever thinks otherwise must have a very mean notion of the wisdom and power of God. And here Leibniz is pointing to a really important theological interpretation of miracles. So whenever you see miracles in the Bible, they're always done for some redemptive purpose. So God does miracles in the history of Israel. He does miracles in the lives of Jesus, most in the life of Jesus, most famously by raising him from the dead. But whenever those miracles are done, they're always done for a redemptive purpose. In fact, the Greek words, there's three Greek words that are roughly translated miracles. One of them means a work of power, dunamis. One of them means a sign, semion. And one of them is what we might consider a miracle, or teras. And they're always the word that we call or a wonder, right? And we tend to think of miracles as wonders. But in fact, miracles are always done for redemptive purposes. And what Leibniz is saying here is, he doesn't think that God would need to use these kinds of miracles in natural history. In other words, and if you think about it a step further, the Christian tradition is that when you study science, what you're studying are the customs of the Creator, the ordinary way that God sustains the universe. So the law of gravity describes the customs of the Creator, the ordinary way that God sustains the planetary motion, for example. And so God at other times sustains the world in a different way. So when he raises Jesus from the dead, it's not God intervening in the laws of nature, poking into the laws of nature and doing something. That's a pagan way, an unchristian way of thinking about the world. God is always sustaining the world. And so when he raises Jesus from the dead, or has Jesus walk on water, or etc., he is in fact simply sustaining the world in a less customary way. So that's the basic, pretty uncontroversial theology of miracles. And so Leibniz simply says, well, it seems theologically unlikely that God would have to fix the planets. But you can easily imagine the kind of apologists among in that time thinking, aha, this proves that God exists. Because if God didn't reform the planets would be unstable. The planets are stable, therefore God exists. That would be a very tempting thing. You could say, actually, I can use the law of gravity to prove that there must be a God. Right? And you probably have heard Christian apologists do similar arguments about other things that we don't understand in the natural world and saying that these are evidences for God. Luckily, Leibniz or Newton, I mean, Newton Newton wrote more about theology than he wrote about science. He was obsessed with Daniel and with prophecy, and actually was probably not a very good theologian and certainly not a very orthodox one. But he was hugely influenced and driven by theological concepts. And so this brings us a little while later in a very famous 5-volume series on the celestial mechanics with Pierre-Simon Laplace. And so Laplace, there's an apocryphal story, I think, where Laplace presented these books to Napoleon. And Napoleon says, but, you know, why have you not mentioned the Creator? And Laplace famously said, je n'avais pas besoin de cette hypothèse-là. I had no need for that hypothesis, which is often given as a kind of atheistic statement. Laplace showed that he didn't need God. God doesn't exist. But actually, Laplace was a practicing Catholic of, again, somewhat dubious faith. But I don't think this was, I think he was just bragging. Laplace was saying, look, I've solved, by doing these equations to higher order, the problem of the stability of the planets. And he was bragging that he had done that. It was a great problem. And he didn't need to invoke miracles to do that. He could show that the laws of gravity in themselves generate the stable planets. Now, it turns, if you do these calculations to even higher order, then Laplace was wrong as well. Right? And I'll just show you one paper from about 10 years ago that says, our understanding of the solar system has been revolutionized over the past decade, so quite recently, by the finding that the orbits of the planets are inherently chaotic. And the real answer for the stability of the planets to this day hasn't been proven analytically. It can only be shown numerically to pretty high precision. It's a complicated problem. And to understand it, you need to understand something about what we call chaos theory and islands of stability, etc. Those are the kinds of tools that were not accessible to Laplace or to Newton and needed hundreds of years of very hard work in order to develop. And so what that shows you is that if Christians had latched on to those arguments early on and tried to say this proves or disproves God, at some point that would have been very problematic. It would be a kind of a God of the gaps type argument they would have fallen into. And in fact, it took hundreds of years for this to be settled. And so this tells us that we as Christians, we need to be, some of the problems that we're working on may take generations for us to work out, and we may not live to see the proper, fully orbed understanding of what's going on. And to be honest, the stability of the planet is an incredibly simple problem compared to some of the other problems that we're working on today in our labs, and it may just take a long time. I have a friend in Oxford, Nigel Bigger, who's a professor of theology there, quite well known, and he gave a talk last year to us on what are universities for. And what was interesting, it was a nice talk, well worth listening to, but what was interesting about his talk is that he said, you know, I started as an undergraduate feeling a call to the life of the mind, and now 30 years of thinking about what a university is for, I feel for the first time that I might be able to tentatively say a few small things about what they might be for. And that's, you know, that's 30 years of hard work by a very brilliant man. And I think this is, again, something that our instinct is often to want to have a solution, to think about it, read a few people, and then say, this is what it's all about. Sometimes that's not going to work. Sometimes life it's going to be hard and take a long time. So that was the first one, immediatism. I think we all kind of understand that, but it's important for Christians to remember, because I've been in many Christian church situations where somebody sometimes comes in and gives a very solid answer to a complicated problem. I think, you know, maybe we should wait a little bit. The other problem that Noel points out is anti-traditionalism, which privileges one's own current judgments on biblical, theological, and ethical issues, however hastily formed, over insights from the past, however hard won and carefully stated. And part of this is that it's really important for us to remember that we do our work in community. And for this, I quote the great scholar W.H. Pooh, also from just around the corner here at the same institution, Trinity, where Newton was. When you are a bear of very little brain and you think of things, you find sometimes that a thing which seemed very thingish inside you is quite different when it gets out into the open and has other people looking at it. And what he's basically saying is that oftentimes when we think on our own, the things may be very, very thingish. But this is why we work in community. And in fact, the reason why, if you think about the scientific community, the scientific enterprise, it's full of collective error-correcting mechanisms. We have peer review. We're constantly being assessed. That's one of the reasons why we have that deep insecurity that you see in the academic world, where part of it is because you are always being assessed by other people. And that's necessary. Your work is being assessed and being critiqued because we recognize that fundamentally we need a community of scholars to come to real knowledge about the world. In fact, I'll go forward and backwards. So here's one of my great heroes, Richard Feynman, and he has a lecture called Cargo Cult Science, in which he talks about the first principle for a scientist is that you must not fool yourself, and you are the easiest person to fool. And I often need to give this to my students because my students often fool themselves. And I think the first thing I want for my students is that when they show me data or something they've calculated, I want to make sure that they've thought of every possible way they could have made an error, because they can easily fool themselves, particularly if they think that I, the supervisor, I say, well, if you should do this calculation, I think it's going to have this result. Sometimes their temptation is to make sure that result comes out because that's what they want. They want to please me or want to do what they do. But I would much rather them not fool them, not get the result, but have figured out what their errors are, then get the result, and then me finding out a while later that something went funny along the way. And this is a historian, Peter Harrison, that I greatly admire, historian of science. And he basically, I won't quote the whole quote here, but basically what Peter has worked out in a series of books, and in fact a nice lecture he gave here in Cambridge in 2005, is that in the birth of modern science, one of the really key steps was a re-understanding of the doctrine of the fall. And so in what we might call pre-scientific days, there was a sense that you could sit in a chair and think about the world and get real truthful knowledge about the world, vertical knowledge about the world. And so you see, once people started recognizing through the Reformation the importance of the fall, the idea that we're fallen, that our minds may not always get things right, that we're easily fooled, we see that people start advocating for a different way of thinking about the world, which involved communal observation, accumulation of observation in different conditions, and that eventually becomes some conditional conclusions on the basis of this long, complicated experimental process. And this is a radically new approach to observation. And so what we see is that actually the scientific world has deeply Christian roots, not only in its history, because many great scientists were Christians, for example, but also in the way that it works, in that kind of collective error-correcting mechanisms. And that's an important thing to remember, that this is something deeply Christian, which sometimes Christians have lost, and they want to jump to conclusions quickly and not necessarily look at what everyone else has done. A linked point that Moll talks about is what he calls populism, which confuses winning supporters with mastering actually existing situations. And so I'll give you one example of where that is definitely the case. So let's take a common, difficult question for the church, issues like creation and evolution. So here in Eden, I don't need to tell you that much. You have some of the world's greatest experts, like Dennis Alexander, here in the congregation. But this is a difficult question. How do you think about Genesis and the origin of life, about evolution and those kinds of questions? It's one of my own personal pet topics. Now, what happens in practice, if you look at the Christian world, there are quite a lot of populist organizations, particular organizations that promote the ideas of a young earth, the earth being young and not old. And these organizations don't really engage in large-scale scholarship. They're by and large interested in getting in populism and getting their views to the public, and that's hugely problematic. That means I think they've largely they haven't engaged properly with the difficulties of the life of the mind. Now, Christians in the pews have justified skepticism of academia. You look in the academic world, there are lots of wacky ideas that academics believe. There's a famous quote by George Orwell: "One has to belong to the intelligentsia to believe things like that. No ordinary man could be such a fool." And you have to just look around your colleagues and friends in the university, and you'll see examples of those kind of crazy ideas. I mean, in the Netherlands, some of the greatest supporters of Stalinism were the academics, right? And you think, well, how could they be such fools? Well, there's a justified skepticism. But on the other hand, what would the church do? What should the church do when it wants to think about a question like creation, evolution, and Genesis? Well, the problem is that there's questions in biblical scholarship, like what did the original writers of Genesis mean? What was the original context in which it was written? There's questions of systematic theology. How do these things fit into the great doctrines of the church? There are really important philosophical questions, like what can science tell you, what can it not tell you? What are the philosophy of science type questions that are being raised? There's historical questions, like where did these things, ideas come from? What are the streams of thought that we're engaging with at this time? Each of those separate subjects, really, to understand them properly, you need people that have spent, communities that have spent their lives engaging with each of those things. The reason for that is that they're complicated, and obtaining reliable knowledge about the world is difficult. So the problem for us at a church like Eden would be, for example, who do you turn to when you've got questions about that? You can't turn to one person on their own, because no one person will have that knowledge. There needs to be a community of scholars. But then which community of scholars do you trust? There is no community of scholars of that type. Sometimes people talk about a magisterium, which is a word in Catholic circles, where they talk about a body of scholars. And of course, the Catholic Church has the great advantage of, by being centrally organized, that it does have the luxury of having people spend their lives thinking about these things. And so, for example, when there's an encyclical on a particular topic, that's often decades of thinking and working and thinking through and argumentation until something emerges that seems like a consensus. And we as evangelicals don't have that, for the very reason that we're not centrally organized. That may be a good thing, but the downside of it is that when we're engaging with a difficult topic like this one, we don't know where to turn. And let's think of many other topics: Christians in politics, ethical questions, development questions, all kinds of questions that the church does want to say something on. It's difficult. It's not so clear where to turn to, who to trust. So that's the issue. And I think the last issue really for Christians to remember is that obtaining reliable knowledge is difficult. So perhaps the most important thing you learn as a graduate student is how hard it is to obtain reliable knowledge about the world. The vast majority of students, when they start, think they're going to make a lot more progress on their topic than they actually do. And one thing you learn is that actually generating knowledge that that can be trustworthy is difficult. It takes years of work to sometimes work out what seems to be like a small thing. And that's just the way the world is. The world is complicated. And that's why you need a community of scholars to work this through. And that means that some things may take us a long time to sort out, right? And we need to be patient, and we need to generate communities that do that. And at the moment, those communities aren't there. And so because of that, sometimes Christian scholars are frustrated with the church. So my experience is that sometimes Christian scholars who then do delve into something in great depth are frustrated when the church deals with these things in what they think are simplistic ways. And the reasons for that are partially structural reasons. And this is where we are. It's not an ideal situation. I think it's something that can change over time, but something to keep in mind. So now I want to get to the last section, which is, again, looking at more negatively at some of the problems that we have, the common traps we can fall into. And this is the thing I think are important for us as Christians to remember. And I would say I have three headings: pride, isolation, and compromise. And this I get from a lovely little book that I highly recommend everyone of you read, called A Little Exercise for Young Theologians by Helmut Thielicke. Thielicke is a famous German theologian and university president. And he talks about theologians, the young theologian, but you can put in the young physicist or the young economist in there as well. Young men, in the same way, be submissive to those who are older. All of you clothe yourself with humility towards one another, because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. It is possible, and laymen have a very exact perception in regard to this, that theology makes the young theologian vain, and so kindles in him or her something like Gnostic pride. The chief reason for this is that in us men, truth and love are seldom combined. So I think that this is one of the biggest struggles or temptations that young academics and all academics face, which is the problem of pride. And that's one of the reasons why we're incredibly fortunate that we have good church communities where we can engage with people who are not academics, and they can help us see some of the weird ways that we value things and value ourselves. But it's an incredibly important thing to remember that this is one of, I think, the besetting sins of the academic world. And it has all kinds of consequences. So one of them, which Thielicke calls odium theologicum, the pettiness of little men who care too much about big issues. So let me give you an example of that some of you may recognize. So let's say you're working in the humanities and you're interested in literary scholarship. So what you'll see there is that there's a wide range of thoughts that can be loosely put under the category of postmodern thought. Now, a lot of Christian churches, it's a little bit less in vogue now than it was maybe a few years ago, but it was kind of in vogue for pastors to say, oh, postmodernism, bad. And the number of times that I've, and the problem with that is that actually the postmodern literature is very complex. And actually there's some very helpful things that postmodern thinkers show us. What they show us, I think, is how to unmask idolatry. And so what some people say is they have a very, very good, actually a very, very good doctrine of sin, of sinfulness. They show in many ways where sinfulness is there in structures, is there in things that we read and things that we write. And those are the useful things that Christians can link to. What they miss is a doctrine of redemption and what to do with it, but they point out the sin. So what happens is the young scholar reads various postmodern thinkers and says, actually, it's not all bad. There's some really helpful things these guys are pointing out to us. Then he hears the pastor in the church thundering about why postmodernism is bad, which usually the pastor means something along is really connecting to relativism, the idea that all truths are equally, that your truth is as good as my truth, which I think genuinely that is something we should combat, but conflates the two. And then, huff, puff, huff, puff, but, you know, but Foucault didn't really say that. Foucault actually said this. And I call that odium theologicum, the pettiness of little men who care too much about big issues. And you can name your own issue that you're working on. Invariably, if you hear somebody speaking about it from the pulpit, they won't treat it with the proper respect that you're used to. And part of the reason for that odium theologicum is that what you're trained very strongly in academia, and rightly so, is to look for internal inconsistencies. So in my own field, the number of papers that are published vastly outnumber, I can't ever read all of them. And so if it's a paper by an author I don't know very well, I might start reading. And usually when the first few lines, when they're given the introduction, I'll think, oh, I'm not sure that's quite the right white way of thinking about what others have done, and then I'll skip to one or two things, and I'll think, oh, I probably don't need to read it. And the fact is that 95% of the literature in my field, I don't need to read, because it actually doesn't really generate any useful, real new knowledge. That's just the way the world is. So you're trained in looking for these inconsistencies. If somebody doesn't quite get these things right, that usually is a signal that I shouldn't worry about their new things they're doing. But that is a very unhelpful way of gauging a sermon, for example. So let me give you another example. You're doing theology. You've got a very sophisticated understanding of some particular subject of theology. You hear a preacher preaching on it. Inevitably, they're not going to quite have it all in balance, right? Because they're not necessarily looking at all the scholarly details. They're not. It's because the fact is that I need to hear a lot of things that a very uneducated, unacademically educated preacher wants to say to me, because I need to be edified in all kinds of very basic things, like how I treat people around me, how I think about myself. Those are the kind of things somebody with no education can often point out really, really well. I like to say sometimes that the spiritually mature are easily edified. So one of the signs that I find for myself is that if I'm in a situation where I think, well, that's not quite academically right, I still need to be able to see where God could edify me through that. But the temptation for young scholars is to start getting an Odium Theologicum is the first one. Another example of where this happens is in academia, you're trained to work in abstractions. You're also trained to explore ideas and think about them. What if this? What about that? And that means sometimes you talk about things that really matter as if they don't. And that's a skill that you learn. But the average person doesn't learn that skill, because that's a very odd academic skill that you have. And so when you then have a conversation with somebody in church, and you start saying, well, but what if it was this way? You're just trying to explore an idea and see where it ends. You may not be actually, you're able to do that. You've trained yourself to do that. But the average person in the pews might find that difficult. It might react to you in a negative way. And then if you are already a little bit prideful, you think, hump, 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 hump. And so we get these critical, we should have critical minds, but not critical spirits. And I push on this because I've been doing these kinds of talks for a long time, traveled around quite a few countries and talked to Christian academics. And almost always, if I have a group of Christian academics and I say to you, so, how is your church? And out come the complaints, right? And I think a lot of that comes from these types of Odium Theologicum issues. That's not to say that we should therefore just be complacent and let things go by. Right? So if in my church I feel that the preacher preaches on the topic of creation and hasn't done it justice, I might pull him aside afterwards and try to help him think about it in a slightly better way. But I'm not going to insist that he understands everything exactly the same way I do. May not have the time to do that, right? And the reason why this is important is because pride leads to isolation. So the next step that I've seen in a lot of academic lives is that pride, this kind of sense that somehow the church isn't quite up to scratch on the topics that you care about, leads to isolation. And I think that is the next real issue. So famously, in Hebrews, it says, do not quit meeting together, as some people are in the habit of doing. Instead, encourage one another even more, since you see the day coming closer. This is why a local Christian community is incredibly important. So when I was here in I spent a lot of time working with the Christian Graduate Society, because having some kind of local Christian community where you are being discipled, reading the Bible and thinking about these things, is incredibly important to your overall Christian life. And it's incredibly important to your discipleship. And you need to seek, wherever you go next, you need to seek that out. One thing that most of you will find is that you leave Cambridge and you leave the warm amniotic fluid of Eden Baptist Church into the wild outdoors world. And it will be tough. You might be in a situation where there are no other academics in the church, or very few. And they won't understand quite what you're dealing with, what you're struggling with. And so you need to find a way of nevertheless engaging and serving. I think one of the things I try to tell students is that when you go to the next place and you go to the next church, don't think about, is this church going to serve me? Think about, how can I serve this church? Where can I serve? What can I do? Even if it's as simple as cleaning the toilets. I think that will, because you need that community, as difficult as you might find that community to be. So that's an incredibly important thing. Now, besides that local Christian community that each of us needs, and besides the fact that it's really important to engage in that community, maybe I'll take one sidestep and say, I've always done, in some way or the other, in some kind of evangelistic course, whether it's an Alpha course or a Visa course or something of that nature. And that's really important for me as well. As a spiritual discipline, I need to be engaging with non-Christians and their questions to keep my faith alive. In my church in St. Aldate's in Oxford, we pray for people at the end, for people that are ill or people that need some Christians. And I've always volunteered for the prayer ministry because I've realized that when I pray for people, it has little to do with my intellectual acumen, whether God does something or not, or whether they feel blessed. It has a lot to do with other aspects of what it means to be a fully orbed human being. And so this brings me to the next point of this isolation, which is that what you also need as an academic is something of a global intellectual community. So let's say that you're, and this is particularly true for those of you that work in fields that may be corrosive to faith. So I think this is the more you move into the social sciences and the humanities, the more that these fields themselves have really strong cultures that may be antithetical or have aspects to them that are antithetical to faith. As helpful as they are on the one side, they can be difficult on the other side. And so for those reasons, you need a global intellectual community. So let's say that you're working on some topic of welfare economics. There should be Christian ways of thinking about that. The probability that another Christian has gone ahead of you in this place where you are is pretty small. But the probability that somebody has done that in a different place, either in the UK or a wider field, is pretty large. And so it's really important to seek out those kinds of people, to engage with them, to talk to them, to think with them. I think that's incredibly important. So, for example, in Oxford, we have, I think I told you this, one of the things that we do is we have this Oxford Christian Mind course, which is basically there's about 30 of us who are academics who teach a course to the postgrad students, not unlike what you're doing today. And this lecture here is part of the first opening lecture to that course. And we do a general one, which is on looking at kind of big theological themes and how it links to the academic world. And then we have streams, which are, we have a history stream, a literature stream, a science stream, a social science stream, and a law stream, in each of which scholars, so academics from that field, interact with the students from that field. And that's just, I think that's incredibly important for our students to already start engaging with people that have moved a little bit further along, that can help them think through the big questions of their field. So let's say, for example, that you are a legal scholar. You're a legal scholar. It's unlikely that you, as a graduate student, as a PhD student, will have enough of an overview of the field to even be able to see which bits of the field, as a Christian, you might want need to think differently about. You first have to learn the craft, and that may take many years of hard labor before you actually understand what people are really doing. The same is true in something like literature. It takes many years to get a good grasp of what is really going on before you can even properly critique it as a Christian. If you try to jump in critiquing too early, you're going to start saying things that later you will regret. And so, on the other hand, if you engage with a scholar who's a bit further along, they can help you along and can point you in certain directions and can help you avoid getting tied into knots. And the last thing in this series of points is really, where does isolation lead? And I think it often leads to compromise. So one of the things you do see with Christian academics is that there's a subset of them that do great and they continue flourishing in their Christian lives. But there's definitely a subset whose faith grows colder by degrees. And as they get more degrees, their faith grows colder. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is back to the scandal of the evangelical mind. They don't feel appreciated in their churches, and probably they aren't properly appreciated. That's a structural problem that we have that we'd like to work on, but will take a while. And so we're still working. I think that's something that you just have to keep in mind. But I think also academic fields are often quite all-encompassing in how they think about things. So what happens sometimes is that you warp a certain epistemology, a certain way of trying to understand something, into an ontology, which is the way something is. So epistemology is roughly how you extract knowledge about the world, and ontology is how things are. And so there are all kinds of unquestioned truisms in different fields. So one example would be in the natural sciences. One of the ways that epistemology warps into ontology is that in my lab, I have to take a hermeneutic of suspicion. So I'm always thinking, well, how do I know something isn't right or wrong? I'm always doubting. That's how you make progress, because you're always not quite, you want to make sure that you get everything just right. Because if I make one little minus sign error in my calculations, the whole thing, is, you know, I'll predict the wrong, everything will be wrong. So, on the other hand, in interpersonal relationships, the hermeneutic suspicion is not that helpful. So if I go to my wife and I say, well, I know that you say that you love me, but I'm always going to be suspicious whether it really is true. And let's make sure, I'm going to reserve judgment on whether you love me until I see evidence for it. That's the way that scientists work, right? And that's a very valuable work in the lab. But what's going to actually happen is if I take that epistemological view, there is in fact evidence that I will never see, right? For obvious reasons, right? And so instead I have to take a different, when I'm relating with my wife, I assume that she loves me deeply. And I assume that that love is unconditional and true, even though, until I see overwhelming evidence that that isn't the case. I take the opposite kind of a view. And I step into that fully, not necessarily based on empirical evidence. And there's a wide range of other human relationships that we need to behave in this kind of way. Otherwise, it messes up. So that's an example of, and if you're around the scientific world enough, you'll meet people that start trying to live their whole lives in a scientific ways, and it's incredibly, it's actually incredibly limiting and incredibly odd, and subhuman. I think also there's also ways that, you know, let's say that you're working in the social sciences where you're trained to look at the way social structures affect the way people behave. If you're not careful, it can quickly become that you start analyzing everything, including the church, purely in terms of social dynamics, who's up, who's down, what's working, these kinds of things. And it can warp the way you view people and warp the way you think about the world, et cetera, et cetera. So those are difficult issues. So here's a very famous philosopher, Alvin Plantinga, who wrote a lovely essay called Advice to Christian Philosophers, who said, first, it isn't just in philosophy that we Christians are heavily influenced by the practice and procedures of our non-Christian peers. The same holds for nearly any important contemporary intellectual discipline, history, literary, and artistic criticism, musicology, and the sciences, both social and natural. In all these areas, there are ways of proceeding, pervasive assumptions about the nature of the discipline, for example, assumptions about the nature of science and its place in our intellectual economy, assumptions about how the discipline should be carried on, and what a valuable or worthwhile contribution is like, and so on. We imbibe these assumptions, if not with our mother's milk, at any rate in learning to pursue our disciplines. In all these areas, we learn how to pursue our disciplines under the direction and influence of our peers. So that's just the way that the university works. There are lots of local moralities, if you want to call them that. So there are local moralities that structure how you should do publications, who should share authorship, and all those kinds of things. There are local moralities about what is truly important and what's not truly important. I recently was talking to a colleague, and we were talking about a third colleague, and he said, oh, yes, but, you know, I know he's written a lot about other things, but how serious of a scientist is he really? But which he meant, how many publications has he been producing recently? Because in that man's sphere, that's really the primary thing that tells that you're a serious person. And so that's part of the sphere of morality. And when I talk about sphere of morality, if you do sports, you probably know about spheres of morality. You know what's said in the locker room stays in the locker room. Those kinds of spheres of morality that are used. What happens on the field stays on the field. There's a sphere of morality. It's just business. That's a sphere of morality. Those are all kinds of things that float around that we recognize. And as Christians, we should take a step back and ask ourselves, is that really true? And moreover, if we're behaving as Christians, we need to think about how those things affect us and in our daily lives. And so why does that lead to compromise? Well, one reason it leads to compromise is because we get sucked into these ways of thinking about the world. But I also think, from my own experience of dealing with academics, that, and this is particularly true of younger people as they move on to academia, is that they can get caught up by what I call secondhand arguments. So oftentimes the times when Christian students have the biggest difficulty in their discipleship is earlier on when they're first moving into an academic field, and they suddenly, new vistas are opened, new grand ways of thinking about the world are seen before them, and they think this is incredibly exciting. And so for example, I've met quite a few young Christians who've been very, very worried by the kind of Dawkinsian language. So Dawkins famously wrote a book, The God Delusion, and a series of others. Now, in fact, what's interesting about that book and about the literature that surrounds it is how poor a lot of those arguments were and how recycled a lot of them were. And I thought I'd just give you a counterexample, a counterquote by a naturalist philosopher called Quentin Smith, who's an atheist, edited a journal called Philo. And in this, about 10 years ago, he wrote an article called The Metaphilosophy of Naturalism. And in that article, he complains about the state of philosophy, particularly philosophy of religion. And he says, quickly, naturalists found themselves a bare minority, so naturalists as people are atheists in philosophy, with many leading thinkers in various disciplines of philosophy, ranging from philosophy of science to epistemology, being theists. The predicament of naturalists is not just due to the influx of talented theists, but is due to the lack of counteractivity of naturalist philosophers themselves. God is not dead in academia. He returned to life in the late 1960s, and now life and well in his last academic stronghold, philosophy departments. So this is a comment on what's been a turn to a lot of Christians have moved into analytic philosophy, particularly analytic philosophy, and a lot of very, very famous ones are theists. And so Quentin Smith is complaining about that, because back in the 1960s, it used to be a properly atheistic discipline, and now there's all these Christians. But then he says, you know, if you were to take the best naturalists and the best theists and put them in the room, the theists would win. The justification of most contemporary naturalist views is defeated by contemporary theist arguments, which he sees as a great problem. And so he says to naturalists, we need to rearm ourselves and fight that battle, because at the moment, on the argumentation level, we're losing. Now, that's one person's view. Not everybody may agree. But it does, if you compare that to the popular debate, it's fantastically different. Right? So if you talk to philosophers of religion and you ask them about the kind of the more meaty versions of the popular arguments that you see in the news, they're a lot more cautious, and they're much less likely to make the kinds of claims that Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris and others make. And the reason is because they understand the counterarguments. What happens is you'll find a Christian student starting to learn more about these things and getting confused and getting worried about their faith and leading to compromise, often based on secondhand arguments. And part of the reason for that is that you need a long time and a lot of, and you need a certain intellectual acumen to be able to understand the subtleties of the philosophical arguments that are being held at the highest level. And so you can easily get compromised by what I consider to be secondhand arguments. And the last point about compromise I wanted to talk about is this questions of self-image and identity. So one of the funny things about the academic world is, as Judd pointed out earlier, that a lot of academics are unbelievably insecure. And one of the reasons they're insecure is because you're constantly being judged by other people. So when you're a student, you hand your things into your supervisor, who looks at it and judges it, and you probably desire the approval of your supervisor. At some point, you'll apply for funding or for a postdoc, at which point your CV and your work gets laid before some other people who will then judge it and then tell you whether you are or are not the right person. That's a difficult thing. And this never stops. So as an academic, you're always being you're being assessed regularly in various committees. Every time you apply to a grant, you have to put a little blurb about how great you are and why they should give you this money. And so this happens continuously. And so it's very, actually, as much as academics often like to think of themselves as being nonconformists, they're unbelievably conformists, because they're continually being, because it's so important for them to conform to a certain subset of people. Right? And so I have a friend who was an economist, and he organized a conference in honor of Milton Friedman, who's a very, very famous Nobel Prize-winning economist. And I guess in the Nobel Prize-winning economists, Milton Friedman is close to the top of the contemporary ones. And he invited a bunch of Nobel Prize winners. So the Nobel Prize is about as high as it gets in economics. And he said it was the most difficult conference he'd ever organized, because the Nobel Prize winners were arguing amongst themselves about who would be the opening and the closing, and who would be the, you know, just little things like the order of the talks. And they got really angry and huffy about it. And you think, why did that matter? Well, because apparently for these Nobel Prize winning economists, it really mattered where they were in respect to Milton Friedman. And there's a funny, it's a really funny combination of pride and insecurity. And that comes because our self-image and identity is so incredibly determined by what other people do. And so you'll see that, that among academics, we spend a lot of time talking about, well, how smart is that person really? How smart is X? How smart is Y? It's a continuous part of conversation. And if you're not really careful, it becomes the primary way in which you generate your own sense of self-worth. And of course, for Christians, it's obvious that that is not where our worth comes from. Our worth comes from the fact that we are loved by God. It has nothing to do with whether we're smart or less smart. But it's an incredibly corrosive and strong culture. And so we have this incredible conformity culture in the academic world, and it brings a set of rewards. And as Christians, that's something we have to actively fight against, something which we need our church fellowships to help us to stand strong. I just think it's so, for example, I remember when I finished my so it's definitely the case that for a lot of our academic colleagues, research is the only thing that really matters. It's the research thing that really brings you to the next level. And so this is why they sometimes work really long hours, right? And in fact, one of the ways that various kinds of institutions become very successful is precisely by convincing the people in their institutions that the only way they're going to really become somebody is by working these incredibly long hours or working incredibly hard. That's not true just of academia. That's true of corporate lawyers and business people and business consultants. And what makes a company successful is sometimes actually its psychological ability to convince the people that are working there that the only thing that really matters is the work. There's a fascinating series of articles in The Guardian by an anthropologist who went and talked to a bunch of bankers. This was not long after the banking crisis. And he also, what was pretty fascinating, there's a little section where he talks to the spouses of bankers. And they talk about, you know, one of the quotes was, you know, during the delivery of the baby, he was out on the conference call and he wasn't going to come back until the conference call was finished, because that's how that community, some of those banks work. And that's why they're, of course, very successful, because they have generated a sense of self-worth that is completely tied into how much money you make in that case. But academia does exactly the same thing in a different way. And so we have to be very careful as Christians that we don't get caught up by that. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It's the Lord Christ you are serving. Now, having said that, I do think that it may be that if you are called to theoretical physics, it may be that you have to work very long hours as a theoretical physicist and work really hard. It may be that to really generate something new, that you need to really, really dedicate yourself to it. It doesn't mean that you therefore only can work 40 hours a week and have to spend the rest of the time doing real things. But if you make that choice, then you need to be clear in your mind that this is something that God has called you to, because it's not obvious that would be the case. And you want to be very careful that you're not doing it because instead it's the community around you, and it's an incredible way of molding your self-identity and your self-image that's driving you to do this. So that brings me to the end of my talk. I talked to you about academic pursuits as a godly vocation. I talked about the scandal of the evangelical mind, some of the difficulties we might have with our churches. And then I talked about Odium Theologicum and other pitfalls that young academics and old academics can fall into. Now, I want to say a few things about this as I end. One is that we're writing a book at the moment in Oxford with some colleagues on a slow burn on these topics. So if you have any thoughts or wisdom or things you think I said that you would say, that you think could be said better, or you have good examples or other things you think I should have said, then please let me know, because I'm looking desperately for feedback. So that's something to think about. Maybe even lunch you can say, you know, you should have talked about this or not talked about that. And, you know, there's some big things that I missed and didn't talk about. I didn't talk about working at all in detail how in your own field your faith may help you contribute to the shalom of that field. And obviously for each of you that's going to play out in a different way. I didn't talk about a really important difficulty for people, or I only talked about it indirectly, which is how do you balance time, energy, family, friends, church, evangelism. I know from experience that that's probably for many of you the most thing, that one of the things that you're most thinking about as a Christian academic. I didn't talk at all about the importance of prayer in our academic life, as important as that is. And those are just a few of the things that I missed, and I'm sure I missed many, many more. So with that, I thank you very much, and see if you have any questions. Okay. Yes. We thank you that you are with us. We thank you that you created all things, that you sustain all things. We thank you that you've called each of us to follow you and to serve you with all of our hearts, our souls, our minds, and our strength. And we pray that you would give us wisdom as we think about our lives, about the world around us, that we would serve you and be faithful to you and to your word. We pray for this food that before us, pray it bless it to our bodies and strengthen us. We pray these things in your precious name. Amen.